From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. The world is a different place than it was 2.5 years ago, before we even knew the term COVID-19. The possibility of a global pandemic seemed like the stuff Hollywood movies were made of, not something that we'd live through, or for many who wouldn't survive it. And now, as we live with the sorrow and the change the pandemic brought, has it taught us anything? Well, joining us today to talk more about this is Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. Dr. Pate, it is always good to have you here.
Thank you, Gemma.
So, Dr. Pate, it's, I think, kind of difficult to actually think of the world pre-COVID. I mean, it kind of, I don't know about you, but it kind of reminds me of pre-9/11. And I know, like, when I talk with my kids about how you used to be able to walk all the way to the gate at the airport, and they kind of look at me like I'm crazy. But it's one of those things where you can remember these moments of life before COVID, but it's kind of difficult to remember what normal seemed like.
Well, you're absolutely right, Gemma. There's in so many respects, it seems as though we all have been changed to some degree. Some more than others, but absolutely. And, you know, and particularly my heart goes out to all of those children who lost their parents or lost their primary caregiver through this. I think, you know, they have paid a tremendous price for this.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Pate, what kinds of lessons do you think that maybe we as a community or society may have learned through COVID? Because I have to admit, there are days where I think we have learned nothing. And then I shift my thinking and I think, you know, we have learned some things, at least in particular, maybe resiliency being top of the list.
Well, and Gemma, that's a great point. I think, you know, you look at those folks and those and their children who came through all of this and not visibly worse. A lot of that's the resilience. And you're right. I saw adults who during this, the very worst came out in them. Anger, resentment. And I've seen examples where those parents also imposed all that anxiety and anger on their children. And, you know, one of the things when I was growing up is I knew my parents were always in charge and they could handle anything and we'd be fine. And that's how children should feel. And I think when children see their parents, you know, whether it's at a protest or a school board meeting, and they're yelling and screaming, or they're breaking down, crying, I think it's understandable that our children are going to take on that anxiety and think, oh my gosh, the world is not in control because my parents are showing me that it's not, that things are not under control. We're not going to be okay. So, you know, and that was an opportunity missed in many cases. To use this pandemic to teach our children resilience. And because, frankly, for many of these children, this will not be the worst struggle or challenge they're going to face in their lives. And this could have been a great opportunity to teach them how you adjust and how you make the best of challenges. But, you know, there are many lessons to be learned. I do wonder whether we will learn those lessons because we seem to repeat them, even though we learned these lessons supposedly before. And we saw that even as monkeypox emerged, that even in this short period of time, we didn't apply a lot of the lessons we should have learned from COVID. But, you know, I think one lesson is that the whole discussion that we had about, you know, should we control the pandemic or should we protect You know, should we control the pandemic or protect business and the economy? It's a false dichotomy. And studies have been done of some of the different approaches taken by countries early on in the pandemic. In fact, those countries that took very significant precautions actually had the best thriving economies. And hopefully now in retrospect, that shouldn't be surprising, because how many businesses had to close because people didn't feel safe enough to give their business to those businesses? How many businesses have struggled because of workers being out sick or now having long COVID, those kind of things? So I think hopefully we learn it's not an either or, it's both. I think another extremely important lesson for all of us as a country is the United States was rated as the most prepared country for a pandemic prior to COVID hitting us. And I think we can see in retrospect, we weren't prepared. And I hope we acknowledge that and realize we weren't as prepared as we thought we should and address that. And I think one of those issues of preparedness is remember back to 2020 and all the shortages we had, PPE. I remember the images of nurses in New York City wearing garbage bags because they didn't have protective gowns. You remember in New York, a shortage of ventilators and the president having to enact the or invoke the National Defense Act to compel companies to make ventilators. And we had significant shortages of many medications. So I think we have to ask ourselves some questions. One, as states, can we count on the federal government? Because we thought, and I certainly thought, that the National Strategic Stockpile would have plenty to help us. We found out that was not at all the case. Do we need to have our own stockpiles here? Like, for example, here in Idaho, do we need to have our own stockpile? Can we count on the federal government? Our legislature's not taking any time to examine these kind of questions. We also, as a country, need to think about the supply chain vulnerabilities. We depend for many of these items, PPE, medications, ingredients for vaccines. China and India are key players. And then you have to wonder, well, if we happen to be at war with them, or if we have a pandemic and that pandemic is affecting China as it was. And remember, China went into lockdown, so a lot of people couldn't even go to the factories and work. India had a major outbreak of COVID with the Delta surge. And so then when that happens, we run low on those supplies. Do we need more redundancies? Do we need less dependence on these countries? Should we do more at home, even though it's cheaper to get it through China or India in some cases? Our federal government needs to have these discussions. And certainly we saw the misstep when the federal government shifted the responsibility for buying supplies to the states, to hospitals, to local organizations. We ended up having to compete against other countries, which meant that we had to pay way more for these supplies than if the federal government had done that. And it meant in many cases, we lost out on those bids and couldn't get the supplies.
And Dr. Pate, can we touch on, I think some of the things we've learned, hopefully, in terms of public health. And what I mean by that is, you know, there was so much misinformation, but then even lack of transparency in some regards. And it was hard to know who to believe. You know, and one being, frankly, the CDC. And this has been under both administrations. So where do we go from here? Because, you know, growing up, I mean, it was like if the CDC said it, you kind of went along with it. But it's, I think it revealed a lot of cracks in that system.
Well, it's an excellent point, Gemma, and it certainly did. And like you, and especially with me being in healthcare, I have revered the CDC until we went through this pandemic. And I'm not sure exactly what happened inside the CDC and how much of this was the particular leadership of the CDC, how much of this was political pressure, how much of this was sacrificing the science for social engagement. I don't know. I don't know all the insides of that, but you're exactly right. And I think there's a number of things that need to happen. First of all, I know the CDC is doing an internal assessment. I wish they were doing it a different way, but I still applaud them for at least doing a reevaluation. But number one is communication, communication, communication. And we know how many times the CDC was unclear and how many times the CDC seemed to be contradictory to the science. And I'm not faulting the CDC for some of the evolution of changes that needed to happen as science, as we learn more. That I don't have any fault with that. But so often they came out with new guidance and did not make clear what the science was behind that. What was the basis for that guidance? And there's, one can go back to the end of last year, 21, when all of a sudden, out of the blue, the CDC changed the isolation requirement to 5 days. That threw all of us in a tizzy. Wait, based on what? What changed? What new science? Do you know something we don't? And the CDC needs to understand that in a pandemic like this, people are going to, you don't have somebody from the CDC on this show to talk about all this. It's left up to many of us locally to try to explain and promote these messages, but they're not even giving us the background for how they made these changes. And I think they haven't communicated enough with local public health departments. And unfortunately, this has undermined the trust in these organizations. And that just makes all of our efforts way, way more difficult. I think another thing for the CDC, if you think back to the very beginning of this pandemic in January, February of 2020, the CDC was telling us, there's no evidence of person-to-person spread for COVID. There's no evidence of airborne transmission, et cetera. And I understand the data was limited, but there are seven other strains of coronaviruses that are transmitted among humans, and we know every one of them is contagious. Every one of them is transmitted through at least respiratory droplets. And I think instead of telling us, well, there's no evidence that of this person-to-person spread, we should assume this virus is going to act like others in its family until we know otherwise. And the reason for that is, frankly, when we were hearing that, and I remember, I was just retiring. When I was hearing that, I was taking reassurance. Oh, wow, this is so good that it's not transmitting person to person. And I think we let our guard down because of that. We did the same thing with monkeypox. You remember all the messaging came out. Oh, it's being sexually transmitted and it's among gay and bisexual men. That is a predominantly true statement. But it's very misleading. First of all, we've known monkeypox for decades. It has never transmitted this way. We should be very resistant to assume that a virus has acquired an entirely new way of transmitting. And what should have been said, rather than calling it sexually transmitted, which maybe it is, maybe it's not, but what we do know is it's transmitted by close contact. And of course, if you are having sex, generally there's going to be close contact. And so why does that make a difference? Well, if you explain that to the public that it's sexually transmitted, the public will think, well, as long as I'm not having sex with a person who's infected, I'm not at risk. That's not true. And of course, as I said on your show, be prepared for the demographics of this disease to change over time. And it has. And now we have seen more women infected, more children infected. And it's because we misled people. And so we have to be careful in how we manage these things.
Dr. Pate, we just got a question in from Anne, and she says, for people who have had long COVID and have seen improvements or recovered, can a new COVID infection give them long COVID again?
That is a fantastic question. We don't know the answer to that question because there aren't that many people that enough time has passed that hopefully they'll be like your case and get improvement or even resolvement of their symptoms. There is reason to be concerned that it could happen again, but we just don't know yet. So obviously, I think what we don't want is someone who's as fortunate as you that you've apparently recovered from this. We don't want you feeling like you're wearing special armor and are now, you know, fully protected from anything bad happening with a future COVID infection. I think that's part of the problem is we just don't know yet what happens to people that are repeatedly infected. We're seeing certainly the evidence that causes us concern about the initial infection, but we don't know the answer to the latter yet. So I pray that you are going to stay over this and not have any more of this, but I can't guarantee it.
And Dr. Pate, Penelope wrote in this morning and she said that she has a friend who home tested for COVID on September 13th. And she took a course of Paxlovid. She's 74 years old. She has high blood pressure. So Penelope wants to know, how long should her friend wait until getting the bivalent vaccine?
Yeah. So what if the 13th of September was when she got infected or first knew she was infected, she should wait 3 months from that date. So we're talking about December 13th at the earliest.
Okay. And Dr. Pate, why is that? I mean, and that's kind of been the case, right? With some of these boosters is you kind of need to wait to get over the symptoms before you should get boosted.
Yeah, that's right. And what has changed this is that we have now followed people post vaccination, post infections, to see what happens to that immune response. And whereas previously we said, well, just wait until you get, you know, kind of over this infection and then you can go ahead and get your vaccine. What we've seen is that once you get the infection or have the vaccine, over the next 2 to 3 months, that immune response is still evolving. And so what we've found is that if you give that immune response time before you try to boost it again, you actually allow it to broaden and actually get to a better place. And then we can boost that response. And so we generally want people to wait 2 months after their previous vaccine dose or 3 months following an infection, just so that we can, you know, get the advantage of that even better immune response from then getting a booster. Now, I will say that there are certain situations where we know somebody is going to be put in a high risk situation sooner than that 2 or 3 months. And we may go ahead and choose to give that bivalent vaccine a little bit earlier to try to protect them from something that they're, you know, for example, they're going to be going on international travel or something like that. We might move up the timeline, but if there's no factors kind of forcing our hand, we really like people to wait 3 months after an infection.
Dr. Pate, I have 1 minute left, but I want to get to this question from Dawn. She said, I believe I got the polio vaccine on a sugar cube in the late 70s. Do I need to get another dose?
No. If you got the sugar cube thing, you got the oral polio vaccine. The question is, did you get all of the doses? Generally, what we did is we gave the oral vaccine, and then later we followed that up as it got developed with the IPV, the shot. And so you might look to see if you have access to your vaccination records from back then, or if your parent remembers. If you're in doubt, yes, it's safe to get the booster, and what you wouldn't get the sugar cube. We don't do that anymore. You get the injection, but it's safe to get it. But if you did get all of the doses, there's no need to.
Okay. As always, Dr. Pate, thank you so much for answering our questions. Of course, Dr. Pate will be back next week. So if you have questions about public health, get them into us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. And Dr. Pate will be back next week. Thanks, Dr. Pate.
Thank you, Gemma.
I'm Gemma Gaudette, and this is Idaho Matters.